requirements. G4 Trust sought to show that the substitute trustee failed to provide proper notice for 21 days prior to the foreclosure sale.
His address.
Pardon me?
His address. That's the notice complaint you have, correct?
That's correct. And the trustee nor the substitute trustee failed to strictly comply with that notice requirement. They did not provide on their notice to disclose their name and street address as required by that amendment.
How do you address the case they cite that says a foreclosure sale cannot be set aside unless the alleged irregularity resulted or caused an inadequate price to be received?
I believe that an inadequate price was received. The G4 Trust was the second lien holder on this case.
What proof do you have of that that was caused by your complaint?
Well,
I perceived somewhat that it could have said that the foreclosure notice must be on blue paper. And your position would be, if it wasn't on blue paper, set aside, because it didn't strictly comply with the statute. So what I'm getting at is, so what if the address wasn't on there? So what? What does that have to do with the notice, availability to make a bid, and the price that was received?
Well, the first opportunity, it gives the debtor the address at which to make the payment on the acceleration of the note.
And do you have proof that he would have made that had he known the correct address?
Well, we know he defaulted on the loan.
Okay.
But he didn't have that opportunity because there was no street address to go to. Secondly, if the foreclosure notice were set aside and the trustee was required to repost, there's always the possibility that they would have gotten a greater price for that property on the subsequent foreclosure.
Because
they renoticed the property, allowed another 21 days, there would have been other parties that would have visited the courthouse on the notice and would have learned about this property. The issue is that the appellee in this case purchased the note at face value from the bank, which there's not any case law that says it's not an issue. The issue is that the compliance with the statute must be a strict compliance when it comes to taking property away. There are several cases on that issue. When you read, you know, one of the arguments in the lower court by the appellee, the defendant in this case, is that the reason that this statute did not apply is because the enabling statute said that it only applied to deeds of trust that were executed after the date that this statute became effective. However, when you read the enabling statute here, it says the changes in law made by this act apply to a security agreement or other contract executed on or before the effective date and to any security instrument or other contract executed after the date of this act that does not conflict with those changes. This deed of trust was executed in 2004, and in Bragg v. Edwards Aquifer, it says in interpreting a statute, the primary question is to ascertain and effectuate the legislature's intent. I believe the legislature's intent was that this law applied to all deeds of trust. Most of these deeds of trust, when you sign one, that power to invoke the sale of that property does not become effective until that power is invoked. And at that time, you have to go to the statute and determine what the law is. And the law in this case stated that the trustee or the substitute trustee must have their on the notice of foreclosure their name and address.
Cases they cited that said substantial compliance is enough, because you're hitting on strict, very strict, letter of the law.
The cases that we have cited, Your Honor, Houston First American Savings versus Music, Because a trustee's power to sell the property is derived from the deed of trust and statute, strict compliance with these requirements is considered a prerequisite to the trustee's right to make the sale. Kane v. State of Texas, the language and legal effect of a statute may require strict construction, meaning a limited, narrow, or inflexible reading and application of it where statute infringes upon private property. I believe that is the case that we have here. I don't believe that the code, based on the case law that we have researched, says that substantial compliance with those statutes is all you need.
Did you look at our case, Powell versus Stacy?
I have not looked at Powell versus Stacy, Your Honor. But when you look at the code, section 51.002B, it requires that notice of the foreclosure sale must be given at least 21 days before the date of the sale. Section 51.0075E of that statute requires the name and street address for a trustee or a substitute trustee to be disclosed on that notice. That is required by section 51.002B. The trustee, in his notice of the foreclosure sale dated August 12, 2008, failed to disclose his street address. When the substitute trustee was appointed on August 29th, 5 days before the foreclosure sale, he conducted the foreclosure sale relying on the prior trustee's notice of sale and posting, and the defect in the notice was not cured. In Terrence Savings v. Lucky Homes Incorporated, that court held that when an original trustee properly posts the notices required by law, there is no necessity for reposting for a valid sale by the substitute trustee. If you look at the deed of trust, as we stated in our brief, it was executed on April 2004, it contemplates the amendments to the Texas Property Code. In paragraph 15, the deed of trust states, in part, the event of default, it shall be the duty of the trustee at the request of the lender to invoke power of sale as required by section 51.002 of the Texas Property Code, as then amended. And the case law provides guidance for these written agreements. In Slaughter v. Qualls, strict compliance with the terms of the deed of trust and statutory requirements is considered a prerequisite to the trustee's rights to make the sale. Furthermore, failure to strictly comply will give rise to the cause of action to set aside the trustee's deed.
Have you found any situations that we could use or that are analogous to this where the parties agree basically by contract to apply law as amended at the time of some future event? I mean, that's really what it comes down to, is we have a contract agreeing to apply law as amended.
Well, in Heritage Resources v. Nations Bank, it said when construing an agreement, the word and phrases used therein are given their plain and ordinary meaning, and the court presumes that the parties intended every clause thereof to have some effect. In Coker v. Coker, the court stated, if the written instrument is so worded that can be given a certain meaning or interpretation, then it is not ambiguous, and the court will construe the instrument as a matter of law. The parties, meaning the plaintiff in the lower case and the defendant, by signature agreed to the terms contained in the deed of trust forming the basis of this contract between the debtor and the trustee in the event of forced sale. To ignore the party's use of this plain and ordinary language would cause the reference paragraph to have no effect. They made an agreement, they signed it, they executed it, and it stated specifically in that paragraph that the statute has then amended. The debtor, the plaintiff in the lower case, gave the trustee the authority to take his property away from him by virtue of this deed of trust. And I believe the case law supports the position that when you take property and you have an agreement and the debtor, the person that owns the property, is allowing someone else to step in and take that property, they should strictly comply with that statute.
Mr. Payne?
Yes, sir.
I'd like to go back a moment to the question that Justice McCoy asked you when we started, and that is on the issue that with your contentions on the leaving off of the address on the notice, how does that get you to a proof of an inadequate price? Because I'm looking at the conclusions that are filed by the trial judge, and it's on conclusions that are listed number 8, it talked about the sale of the deed of trust, note, and lien for $115,925.86. You don't dispute that, do you?
I do not dispute that, Your
Honor.
And
then it says that the bid-in price at the foreclosure was $116,105. So what do you contend should have been the bid-in price if this was inadequate? And what evidence was there of that presented at the trial court?
Well, the evidence that was presented at the trial court is G4 Trust, who was the second lien holder, would have at least bid $256,000 on that. That's the amount of money that the second lien holder had in that piece of property.
Well, the second lien holder knew about the foreclosure, didn't they?
The second lien holder did know about the foreclosure.
So they were not forestalled from being at the foreclosure sale and making a bid had they chosen to do so.
Well, the plaintiff in the case didn't actually give him that notice until after the foreclosure occurred.
About whenever someone got a piece of paper. I'm talking about the fact that on the second Tuesday, whenever this foreclosure occurred on September the 2nd, 2008, the second lien holder knew that the property was going to be struck off for bid on that date at the courthouse steps. Isn't that what the evidence showed?
That's what the evidence shows, because that's the general notice requirement.
If they'd have wanted to have been there to make a bid of $250,000 instead of $116,000, I mean, what evidence did we have that the holder of the note, the Consolidated Gasoline Inc., wouldn't have been glad for them to buy it for $250,000?
Well, that's true, Your Honor. And on the set aside and reposting of that, there is still that opportunity. That's what my client has asked for. That's what he was asking for in the lower court.
Okay. I guess I'm just not understanding that. If the evidence was only that there wasn't a bid made that might have been made if they'd chosen to make it, how would we get to that being an inadequate price?
That's
what I'm having trouble with.
It's my understanding that no one bid on that property except for the person that held the note, which in the bidding process, obviously, if they have a lien against it, they're going to bid, use that amount of that lien to bid on it.
Happens in most all of the foreclosures that I've ever attended, and that the holder of the note will at least, well, not always even bid the amount of debt, but at least if they have debt, they have the authorization to go to that amount, know that that's their bid price, because that's all money. None of that money is going to go to the man who made the note if he just bid the amount of the debt due.
That's correct.
I'm just having trouble understanding how you ever get to showing an inadequate price whenever that's the case here.
Well, using those facts, you can't. But if G4 Trust had the opportunity to bid on it, it would be virtually twice that.
And what I'm asking you is, how was it that they were declined or didn't have the opportunity to bid? How did the address not being in the notice preclude G4 Trust from making a bid at the foreclosure sale on September the 2nd, 2008?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Annette Vanacek. I'm here for Consolidated Gasoline Incorporated. And as you probably surmised from the additional facts that are stated in our appellee's brief, G4 Trust is not entirely arm's length from the debtor in this case. That is, Mr. Gibson also was an officer of JRP Equipment Company, Inc. at the time this debt was incurred in 2004. And I bring that up because part of the evidence in this case showed that 3 days after the foreclosure sale that is the subject of this dispute, JRP Equipment Company, Inc. assigned all of its claims, causes of action, etc., to G4 Trust. However, that disclosure was never provided until sometime during the litigation in the trial court in this case. And I would point the court to the defendant's exhibits 14 and 15, which were filed about 3 or 4 months after the foreclosure sale that was conducted in this case. The points that G4 has raised in this appeal really go to the August 12, 2008 notice that was given by George Bradford, who is the original trustee in the deed of trust that was signed in April of 2004. I point that out because the original deed of trust, which is defendant's exhibit number one and plaintiff's exhibit number one in the record, states the exact address that Mr. Bradford can be located, and that has been a public record since April of 2004. Secondly, I am.
And where is the street address?
The street address is actually on the deed of trust that was signed in April of 2004.
Well, you said George Bradford's letter of that same date and served contemporary with the notice contains the required information.
And that's defendant's exhibit number four.
Mm-hmm. Where is the street address?
On defendant's exhibit number four.
Is that the National Bank of Texas letterhead dated August 12, 2008?
It is, Your Honor. It is there, and it. I believe it's at the top of the letter.
Post office box.
That is the address that is listed in, as far as the communications. There is not a lot and block number listed in that notice. That's correct. That's correct. But that is the mailing address. And further in the record, both Mr. Phillips and Mr. Gibson testified they knew who George Bradford was. They knew where to locate him. They knew how to find him. This was not a surprise to them in this process. Even going back to the point regarding the 2005 amendment to the Texas Property Code, which I think is the first point that the appellee has raised, it is clear in the enabling statute of that particular amendment that it does not apply to contracts that are executed before September 1, 2005. In this case, we have a deed of trust that was signed in April of 2004.
Even if the parties agree to alter that by contract?
Even if that were the case, Your Honor, as I guess taken to its extreme, we could say that the property code was amended to prevent any kind of non-judicial foreclosure sales, and you would never be able to exercise the power of sale. I don't know if that was truly within the contemplation of the parties at the time they signed that particular agreement, or at least the time that Mr. Phillips did. But I do think that it's clear that the legislature did not intend to modify the existing contracts, which is the point that the appellee has raised in this particular case.
But I think the Supreme Court has held you can waive pretty much anything. You can waive your right to a jury trial in a contract. You can waive arbitration rights in a contract. And so I'm having a hard time seeing why the parties couldn't agree to apply a provision of law as amended in the future.
I believe they can, Your Honor, and I believe in this particular case the National Bank of Texas complied with that requirement for the law that existed on August the 12th, 2008. In fact, as the law existed on September 2nd, 2008, they provided the notice of who was going to be conducting the foreclosure sale. There's no evidence before the court in any of the record that the debtor, JRP Equipment Company, and its guarantor, Mr. Phillips, were not aware of their default, never cured it. The testimony from the bank officer, Mr. Reichenbach, as well as the plaintiff, JRP Equipment, was that they knew they were in default. There was no evidence that G4 Trust would have, should have, could have come forward on September the 2nd with a $256,000 bid. There's no evidence to connect even a missing address on the notice to establish that there was an error or an inadequate sales price at the foreclosure sale. Essentially, G4 Trust, who is Mr. Gibson, the former officer of JRP Equipment, is trying somehow to protect his interest in this property. And it's not, as I said in my opening comments, this is not an arm's-length lender who was unaware of the underlying facts of the debt that National Bank of Texas was owed and which was assigned to Consolidated Gasoline shortly before the foreclosure sale. I do want to address one point that was raised in the argument here a few minutes ago. Tarrant Savings versus Lucky Homes allows a successor trustee to rely on the conduct of a prior trustee that's listed in the deed of trust in conducting the foreclosure sale. And in our brief, we cited that at the conclusion of our arguments under point number two. That has long been the case, or that has long been held, that the successor trustee can rely on the conduct of the prior trustee. Consolidated Gasoline did not send another 21-day notice, did not re-notice the foreclosure sale for sometime in October. It's undisputed that Consolidated Gasoline did rely on the notice that's dated August the 12th, 2008, in conducting the foreclosure sale on September the 2nd. And in our brief, we have cited the Gamble versus Martin case, Tarrant Savings Association versus Lucky, and the Loomis Land and Cattle Company cases, which all consistently have held that the successor trustee may rely on the original trustee's conduct. Going back to the August the 12th, 2008 letter and the notice of sale, there was at least substantial compliance with what was required of the law as it existed on August the 12th, 2008. The identity of the trustee who was going to be conducting the sale was given, not perhaps a street address, but an address where they could be contacted was given, and that was not any different than the address in the original 2004 deed of trust contract. All of that information was available to the debtor in this case, who testified at trial that he was out of town and wasn't aware of the fact that the notice had been delivered to his offices in Fort Worth. The testimony from Mr. Phillips was that he was aware of the default, but he individually and personally did not receive a letter because he was out of his offices to which they were sent. What Consolidated Gasoline had asked the trial court to do was affirm the foreclosure sale that was conducted on September the 2nd, and as part of that action, sustain the fact that they are in record title of this property and have the right to convey it at a future date. Currently, their ability to sell this property has been hampered because of the lease pendens and the supersedious bond that's been pending in this case. So we would ask the court to affirm the trial court's judgment, affirm the finding fact and conclusions of law that were found by Judge Cleveland after trial, and sustain the fact that Consolidated Gasoline does have good title to this property. Thank you.
How do we get to, let's say, I'll characterize it as the issue of causation? That doesn't seem to be one of your response points or cross point or whatever.
The issue of causation with respect to the foreclosure sale defects?
The failure to provide a street address didn't cause an inadequate price. How do we get there from these points?
I guess from the outset, the alleged inadequacy of the price, which was $116,000 at the foreclosure sale, that burden to show that it was an inadequate price fell upon G4 Trust or Phillips to the extent that they were claiming that as part of their causes of action. That burden of proof not having been met, there was no evidence as to what price the property would have commanded at a properly conducted foreclosure sale. With respect to the absence of Mr. Bradford's street address as opposed to even a P.O. box address, there is no evidence to connect that omission had any effect on the amount bid at the foreclosure sale. And as Mr. Gibson testified, he was aware prior to the foreclosure sale that the sale would have been conducted on September the 2nd. Thank you.
Mr. Payne, rebuttal?
Just a very short rebuttal, Your Honor. In the case Terrence Savings that we cited, we don't have an issue with the fact that a substitute trustee can use the notice of the original trustee as long as it's a proper notice. And proper notice is a notice that complies with the Texas Property Code. We still contend that there was an agreement in this deed of trust, paragraph 15, when it states that it must comply with section 51.002 of the Texas Property Code as then amended. The power to invoke the foreclosure sale in that instrument doesn't even affect any statute until that power is invoked. Then the statute must be examined to determine what the legal issues are in providing that notice. We still contend that. As far as the price on the property went for the value of the note. We still contend that if the foreclosure were set aside and reposted, that there would be a substantial larger price for that piece of property. And I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Payne. Thank you, Ms. Vanacek. We thank you for your arguments here today. Your case is submitted, and you are free to go about your business.
Thank you.